No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So you should feel free to call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008. Maria, how are you? Welcome.
Good evening, Michael. I'm well. Thank you very much. How are you?
I'm good. And before we get our very special guest on tonight, let me just give one shout out to Trisha Brown, my daughter, who turned 28 today. So
happy birthday, Trisha.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that it's been 28 years, but she's in Chicago. I hope she's listening. Love you, honey. Happy birthday. And with no further delay, let's get our guest on tonight. Tonight, we're lucky enough to have Michael Eric Dyson with us. Dr. Dyson, who received his doctorate at Princeton in theology, is an author of more than 20 books, including 7 New York Times bestsellers. He's a commentator on MSNBC. He has won 2 NAACP Image Awards, an American Book Award, and the Langston Hughes Medal. He's been compared to authors like James Baldwin. As a preacher and sometimes pastor, he has worked for more than 40 years in that capacity, and we're lucky enough to have him here with us tonight. Welcome, Dr. Dyson. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, sir.
We want to talk. His latest book is called Long Time Coming, Reckoning with Race in America. And this is such an important piece of work because it deals with systematic racism. So let's start there, Dr. Dyson. Since the murder of George Floyd, it seems to me that there's become a new awareness of systematic racism, you know, that traditionally it seems we talk about racism on a more personal level, how we deal with each other. But it seems to me that now we're talking more and more about systematic racism. Is that true?
I think so. First of all, thanks to both of you, Senator Brown and Ms. Sanchez, for having me on your wonderful Absolutely. Show. But I think there has been a decided shift in sensibility, in conversation, and in substance, to talk about systemic racism, not just individual bigotry, not just personal feelings and sentiments and passions, but the way in which we continue as a society to reproduce the pathology of a systematic oppression that is beyond what one feels individually, despite one's own intentionality. That the feeling of racism is one thing, the feeling of bigotry is one thing, but the actual practice of racial inequity is another thing still. And I think after George Floyd's death, that was on the lips of so many people. There were so many people on radio, on television, speaking about systemic racism. They understood that it was deeply rooted in systems of oppression that transcend individual belief, individual emotion. And I think that it became apparent after George Floyd's death because police after police have engaged in a similar practice across the country. what does that indicate? It's not simply about individual will and volition. It's also about the systemic inequities that prevail, the perception of black people and brown people, the understanding of who we are as a community, the belief that there's a likelihood and an inclination to commit crime, to see black men as dangerous. These are collective perceptions and stereotypes that are fueled and fed by something larger than individual belief, cultural norms, social habits, and the beliefs of a society all get channeled in reflexes and reactions of police people to black and brown people on the street. So a lot more conversation about that, and I think his death certainly sparked it in a fundamental fashion.
Dr. Dyson, since your book was published in December of 2020, was Long Time Coming in the works, or was George Floyd something that coalesced for you to write the book?
Yeah, I think, obviously I've been thinking about it, you know, given the unfortunate and tragic repetition of black death at the hands of the police. But yes, I believe that, you know, as I look back, that George Floyd's death, along with, you know, the revelation of Breonna Taylor's death and the death of Ahmaud Arbery, really sparked me to try to sit down and write, and to write quickly about what was going on, and hopefully with some depth and insight about what was going on in our society, why we were confronting this, and what we would have to do in order to address it. But you're absolutely right. George Floyd's death was an inspiration and an instigation to really grapple with, you know, the Black Lives Matter protests, the way in which numbers, huge numbers of white people and brown people and, you know, Latinx, Asian, indigenous folk were being involved along with black folk, and what differences that made in terms of how we perceived, you know, not only the history of race, but the contemporary expression of racial animus and anti-blackness, and what we have to do to stem that tide.
You know, Dr. Dyson, I love the Constitution and I love the Founding Fathers, but we have to be honest. They were a bunch of wealthy, well-educated white guys who were also slave owners. So is systemic racism built into the foundation of America? Do we need to go back and take all the way back to the formation of our country and take a look at some of our basic institutions? I mean, President Obama caused a filibuster, a Jim Crow relic, and we know the Electoral College is, you know, was put in place to help Southern states, you know, be better represented. Are these vehicles of systemic racism, things like that?
Yeah, that's a perfectly lucid and eloquent point. Absolutely. We have to go back to the founding fathers, the founding figures, the founding mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters, and those who enabled this country to come into being, those who were acknowledged. Black people were not acknowledged. Women, for the most part, weren't acknowledged.
Right.
And when you look at what President Obama spoke about, you know, the filibuster as a relic of Jim Crow, the way in which the Southern states especially wanted to leverage their authority all out of proportion to their numbers in the country, in the same way that the Electoral College has been used in a similar fashion for those, you know, states in the South that believed in enslavement and wanted to hold fast to their power. So, yeah, these are relics of institutional racism, of systemic oppression that need to be addressed. And we have to grapple with the deeply entrenched bias and the deeply entrenched perceptions that prevail about black people in this country and how those are rooted in, you know, institutions of American society. For instance, Roger B. Taney, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in, I think, 1857, said that black people have no rights that white people are bound to respect. That is systemic oppression at its height.
You know, I asked this question because I see the District of Columbia as kind of an ultimate Jim Crow relic in that they gave us home rule 44 years ago, but Congress still controls everything. So there's an illusion that we're in control when actually we're not in control at all. And, you know, it's kind of the ultimate poll tax or citizenship test or whatever you want to call it. But I agree with you. We need to go back to the foundations. I'm sorry, Maria, go ahead. Ask your question.
Thank you. Dr. Dyson, since you do work on diversity and ethics, what do you think about this movement that we're trying to get with and inclusion and getting positions in companies and corporations to have somebody that oversees that? Is that a top-down thing instead of a bottom-up process? And is it words only, or do they really mean what they say about becoming more diverse?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, it may be top-down in terms of its structure, but it was bottom-up in terms of the response to the protests. Mm-hmm. Had there been no protests in the street, there wouldn't have been the reckoning in corporate America, corporations, with the very, racial insensitivity, anti-blackness, perpetuation of systemic racism, and the insensitivity toward the interests, goals, and aspirations of black people. And look, once you point out that things are wrong and people want to figure out how to make them right, you got to take them at their word. And so I think we have to, you know, hold institutions accountable. I think we have to look at corporate America and say, are you serious about this? And the only way we can tell is if they show up, if they continue to show up, if they make differences and changes in their organizations and operations, and, you know, who's in the room when those decisions are made. And how do we know you're serious? Because you pony up the cash, the capital, the insight, the commitment, and the overall, you know, belief that social injustice must be addressed, that diversity and equity are reasonable expectations and goals that should be implemented in these spaces and places in corporate America. So, yes, I think all of that is extremely important. We got to hold them to account. We got to say that, you know, if you did something wrong, this is how you do it right, and then see if they follow through and then help them follow through. Be there to hold them accountable, but also to supply insight, observation, advice, and support toward the good and powerful goals that they can achieve.
So if we're doing that now, but short of going back 400 years, how do you see us getting there sooner rather than later and not reinventing the wheel, but taking that awareness and taking that leadership and not just talking the talk, but walking it? What does that look like?
Yeah, well, that's a good point. Well, you know, it looks like what we know it looks like, you know. You make a difference. You hire, you know, people at the top of your organization to help make decisions. You have an overhaul of hiring practices that bring more people of color in, that address the misogyny, the sexism, the transphobia. You have actual, you know, in one sense, not only the inspiration, but actual mentorship from the top. If the people who run the place are definitely, you know, concerned and care about the situation of people of color, then that makes a difference about, you know, with those who are beneath. So let it come from the top to the bottom in that sense. Let the head person in charge, the figures who make a big difference in a particular corporation, let them make it as a priority. And when they prioritize that at the top of the corporate echelon, then, you know, people underneath go, well, oh, okay, that's something that they're serious about. That ain't just talk. That's not just, you know, balderdash and trash talk. That's serious. They're trying to integrate it into the fabric of the corporate life. They're trying to make a difference in this the hiring practices and, you know, getting together a committee that will have some kind of power to address the lack of racial or social or political awareness in regard to people of color, BIPOC, Black, Indigenous people of color, and to address those needs as, you know, effectively and as directly as possible, and also to support efforts in the broader society where people are trying to make a difference. So it's not just internal looking and, you know, navel gazing, but it's also about supporting those who are trying to do the right thing beyond one's own corporate bailiwick.
Well, you know, we just got a question from a listener named Sharon, and I think this fits in pretty well. And she asks, beyond patronizing Black businesses and things like that, what is the role of white people? What can white people do to affect this kind of change that you're talking about?
Well, you know, those things are very important. You know, making a difference in corporate America, that's extremely important. Making certain that, you know, they go to their own people, so to speak. White people speaking to white people is extremely important. Because no matter how smart or how intelligent a Latinx or Latina or Black person or Indigenous person is, no matter how many jokes they have and how self-critical they are or introspective they are, it may not, you know, move the needle. But when you go home for Thanksgiving and you can confront in a gentle and yet firm fashion, you know, your parents or your cousins or your uncles or aunts and your kinfolk about, you know, what's happening in this world, and to really get at them when they perpetuate stereotypes and say, no, that's not true. That's not what I see. Now, you know, if you go home for Thanksgiving and do that, you know, or, you know, make sure you get your pumpkin pie first and make sure you get your, you know, turkey and stuffing in. But then after that, you know, hold them to account and say that this is, you know, this has got to change. We've got to make a difference. And then not only individually, but institutionally, as white brothers and sisters have, you know, prominent positions in corporate America, in higher education, you know, in our prison system, begin to integrate into the fabric of your consciousness and praxis and methodologies some of these insights that we're talking about. Don't just let it be some fanciful theory. Make it on-the-ground truth that needs to be applied.
You know, I would just add to that, over Thanksgiving dinner, after you've had the turkey and pumpkin pie and the arguments start, that also you have to be receptive. You know, I always say one of the most important things I learned in life is what Einstein said, where what you see depends on where you stand. And when my children talk to me about race, they have different, they're very liberal, but they have different opinions than I do. They see things differently. So I'm trying to learn, you know, I think of myself as this terribly liberal guy on this issue, but I'm also trying to learn from them, and I think that's very important. And when I was in college, one of my mentors, a guy that later became a mentor to me, Dick Gregory, came and he lectured at my college, and he said that America had always had somebody they looked down on. And, of course, I went to college in the early 1970s, and he said that we were the people, the students, the hippies, the activists, were the people at the time that they were, that America was looking down on. And the first thing they do is they make you believe that you're inferior, you know, like Eleanor Roosevelt, right. Actually, Frederick Douglass, right, said nobody can make you feel inferior without your consent. So how are Black people culpable? What do Black people need to do in addition to what white people need to do?
You know, I mean, I think obviously, you know, we stand up for our rights, which Black people have been doing from the get-go. Mm-hmm. And you know, you got to stand up for your livelihood. You got to stand up for your people. You got to stand up for the historic, you know, situations in which you find yourself. And you've got to be determined to resist that. So, you know, black people have often been the most vigorous defenders of themselves. They have been out there on the front lines trying to raise their voices against white supremacy, social injustice, economic inequality, Jim Crow apartheid. I mean, that's what they've been doing. So they got to continue to do the right thing, so to speak, to continue to be brave, to raise their voices and make certain that their interests are being heard. But we often know that even when black people stand up and exercise their legitimate right to self-expression, that they're often seen as troublemakers, right?
Right.
Look at the difference between, you know, white folks standing up for their rights, especially in 2016, and when they voted Trump in, you know, people were deeply and profoundly, you know, moved, saying this is a referendum on the white working class, even though a bunch of rich white people voted for him, too, clearly.
Right, absolutely.
But when they lost, you know, in this last election, again, they were saying, well, be kind to them, understanding. Well, nobody said, hey, when black people in 2016 lost it, lost the election, hey, be kind to black people. Be kind to your Latinx brothers and sisters, because they've just experienced an enormous difficulty and disappointment, nothing. And then in this last election, we're being asked to understand the plight and predicament of those who just lost. So it seems to be that there's a consistent theme of whatever happens to white people is important, whether they win or lose. And we got to, you know, make certain that we underscore that when we speak about the varieties of ways in which white privilege shows up. And we know that there's a differential treatment accorded to black people and to white folk, to Latinx people and to white folk, when it comes to January 6th and the insurrection versus Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter people, you're thugs, you're, you know, you're anarchists, you're trying to destroy this nation. And all they wanted was freedom and access, you know, to American goods and services. But no, when black people call for that, we are seen as somehow undermining American democracy. And yet people who stand up, who are antithetical to American democracy, holding high the banner of bigotry, that is the Confederate flag, and then, you know, using that banner of bigotry to promote their interests and their heritage, and yet these are the people who seceded from the nation. Colin Kaepernick bends his knee on the gridiron, and he's called an anti-American, anti-patriotic figure, and yet those waving the banner of bigotry, bowing at the statue of Robert E. Lee, elevating the lost cause of the South, are seen as patriots. This is the racist belief that precludes an appreciation for fundamental black commitment to the betterment of this nation as the great patriots that we have largely been, versus white folk who are willing even to subvert the nation in deference to their own narrow goals. We've got a former president still touting the misbegotten belief that he was somehow deprived of the election, that he really won. He's just lying. And those lies get reproduced time and again. And those folk, you know, who have the ability to justify what Trump is doing, to justify this kind of bigoted belief, hold the strings, so to speak, pull the strings of certain media and certain, you know, political forces that allow their side of the story to prevail. So, yeah, we've got to really think more seriously and more, you know, introspectively about how we address these particular issues. So black folk have stood up, need to continue to stand up to defend ourselves, because self-help has often been the only help we've ever known.
Well, you know, if Black Lives Matter had been the people that marched up to the Capitol that day, they would not have gotten near the Capitol. There would there would have been enough National Guards there that they would have never approached the Capitol. And
no question.
Yeah, it's just crazy. Go ahead, Maria. I'm sorry. Give me your opinion.
Well, I'm just curious, Dr. Dyson, since you've been at this for decades, And it, as you said, the moving the needle, it doesn't seem like we've moved it that much, even though we did elect President Barack Obama and there have been...
Just to our audience, I'm sorry for the interruption. This is life as we know it on the internet from time to time. But we're back with Dr. Michael Eric Dyson. Let me ask you another question, Dr. Dyson. You've done best-selling books on Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Tupac, Marvin Gaye, a personal, you know, a hometown hero here in Washington, D.C., Bill Cosby, and President Obama. It's such an eclectic group of people. Is there a common thread beyond the fact that they're all Black? Is there a common thread that's attracted you to writing about all these diverse people?
Yes, sir. Well, you know, I was attracted by their intelligence, their giftedness, their genius, and obviously their traumatic impact in some instances, Mr. Cosby, by their standing in the culture, like with Marvin Gaye or, you know, Tupac Shakur or Barack Obama, Dr. King, you know, the greatest American in my mind who ever lived. Mm. So, you know, these topics, these issues were extremely important to me, and to try to get at the figures, you know, in whom they were embodied, you know, made a big difference. And so I wanted to grapple with them, not just straightforward biographies, but using them as a lens onto a larger political and social and economic landscape, figuring out what was going on, how we could, you know, judge American society through their achievement, measure our aspiration, you know, through their lives, and figure out how we could talk about progress or the lack thereof by using their biographies as a critical engagement with the quest for justice in America. So probably that and their, you know, sheer genius is what drove me to them.
Well, you know, I think that's so important to, it's not only intriguing, but important because it's something, again, that we suffer from here in the District of Columbia. America thinks that everybody that lives in the District of Columbia works for the IRS. So, you know, to show that we actually have doctors and teachers and you know, people like that is very important to us as well. Can we talk about segregation for a minute? You know, I live in a city where we're pretty liberal on as cities go on race, but still, my city is pretty much segregated. The largest population in the District of Columbia is African American, but they're primarily found in two wards of the city, and it seems to me that there's all sorts of problems with segregation, but one of them is that it keeps us apart. What can we do about segregation?
Yeah, I think we have to continually figure out that it's a bane to the existence of America. We continue to resegregate our schools at levels that approach almost before Brown versus Board of Education. And, you know, we have segregated society where Black and white and red and brown and yellow folk, you know, that all these ethnic communities, which are amazing and great, but divorced and divided often by economic inequality and, you know, the persistence of a kind of, you know, agreement with real estate that Black and brown and red and yellow and white folk are going to live apart and live in certain neighborhoods, and it will be steered and guided and redlined and so on. And even though technically those, you know, practices are long since gone, they continue to prevail in a nation where we see such radical inequality in housing. And then the schools we go to, you know, many schools are still nearly lily white or, you know, have disproportionate numbers of white folk that are elite institutions of either secondary education or college education, higher education. There certainly is segregation of means, of wealth. I mean, the average black and brown household pales in comparison to white brothers and sisters in this country. So there's a devastating, deleterious, destructive effect in America because of segregated resources, segregated living, segregated, you know, accommodations that we thought were a relic of Jim Crow from so long ago. And yet, in many ways, we haven't advanced past some of that stuff. But there's been a tremendous great deal of progress in some ways, but in others, not so much at all. So we've got to call it out. We've got to consistently say that we want to support schools that are far more integrated and not just run to suburban life and figure out a way to escape black and brown folk, but we got to figure out ways to include them in the larger circle of American privilege. And we've got to be willing, and white brothers and sisters have to be willing, to be self-critical and to be introspective and to figure out what they can do to challenge the fact that, you know, people who look like you and think like you are usually going to hang out together and figure out new ways to invite, you know, new communities into one's social, political, economic, and educational circle.
Well, you know,
I want to say, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, let me just make this one point. In D.C., just to illustrate what you're talking about, we have a per-pupil funding formula for schools, but when the city cut back on art and other programs in the District of Columbia, my elementary school raised $220,000 from the parents to keep those programs going. Schools in Anacostia just weren't able to do that. I'm sorry, Marie. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. No.
It brings to mind, and this is an archaic concept, but is it time to bring back affirmative action?
Absolutely.
Would that be a solution today?
Absolutely. Great point. I mean, there are big conversations going on now about, you know, a more progressive and engaging form of reparations affirmative action called reparations.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the discourse and dialogue about reparations, which attempts to address the historic legacies of inequity that have prevented, you know, black people from flourishing in this nation, is extremely valuable. And, you know, to talk about affirmative action is extremely important. And it doesn't mean what people think it means. You know, it doesn't mean that, you know, well, we got a bunch of unqualified, incompetent black and brown people or women, you know, to become part of our society. No, it means that historically underrepresented communities, when there's competition over scarcer and scarcer resources, by relatively equal, you know, candidates for a particular slot in, you know, employment or in the schoolroom, that the nod goes to people of color and women because of their historical underrepresentation. And when we throw in white women and other able people and the like, white brothers and sisters benefit more per capita from affirmative action than even black and brown folks. So, you know, there's certainly the necessity of bringing a more nuanced and a more powerful form of affirmative action back and to have a serious debate finally about reparations in this country and hopefully moving toward the time when we can practice and apply those reparations to black people in America.
Because I haven't heard anybody speak about affirmative action for decades. And to me, if you're looking for a diverse and inclusive environment, how are you going to go about that unless you start bringing people of color, or women or indigenous or what have you, into the formula?
Yeah.
It can't just be tokenism. It has to resonate. And what better way to do it than through affirmative action?
There's no question about that. Again, and that, you know, without affirmative action, the NBA wouldn't have black players. So when they had affirmative action in there, even though it wasn't official policy, but they began to admit, you know, black people to the league And think about this. The first black player for the NBA died about 5-6 years ago. That means in our lifetime, the first player to play for the NBA was alive. And you wouldn't say, oh, letting Michael Jordan in is affirmative action in a negative way, or letting LeBron James in or Kobe Bryant, right? You wouldn't say that. And, of course, the first argument will be, well, all the black people who are being let in aren't Michael Jordan, but neither are the white people. That's the point, that white mediocrity is routinely ignored, overlooked. White incompetence is not even considered to be a serious detriment to getting a job or to enjoying some social benefit or getting access to, you know, even higher, you know, institutions of higher education. So, yeah, we've got to really think seriously about how these goods are distributed, and talking about affirmative action and even talking about reparations as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm proud to say on behalf of me and Maria that we had Dr. William Darity from mm-hmm. Duke University on to discuss that very issue on how, you know, how reparations would look. And it's still I'm still unclear about it, whether we have, you know, direct payments like we're seeing now with the COVID stimulus package, or whether they're just investments in things like HBCUs and other institutions that help black people. But let me ask you a question. Since you brought up scarcity, you know, I remember taking economics 101, and the definition of economics was it was the study of alternative, the study of resources and their alternative uses. So we start out with an idea that there is scarcity in our economy. Do we need to revamp that too? Do we need to look at capitalism and say there is enough to go around? It's about redistribution. It's not about alternatives.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, obviously, you know, there's enough to go around. We have this scarcity mentality and this zero sum that we believe will somehow, if you get something, then I don't get what I'm supposed to get. And it's unfortunate because people end up not understanding that we're in this boat together, and that, you know, white folk are not going to lose if, you know, black folk, so, you know, quote, win and get advantage and get opportunity that has been historically prevented and precluded. So, you know, we've got to have a much more open mindset to talk about redistributive mechanisms, to speak about the degree to which this country has been historically inequitable and unequal and denying opportunity and possibility to black people, and how we can, you know, overcome that. And when you think about the history of slavery in this country, all those years that black people worked for free without any compensation, without any ability to be duly recognized, and without, you know, being granted land, in the way in which we were obviously owned, as opposed to being able to own things, when you're reduced to chattel slaves, when you're reduced to a thing, when you're reduced to a cog in the machinery of American capital and white supremacist ideology and imperial politics, then, yeah, we got to do something pretty radical to change things. Martin Luther King Jr. said, a nation that has done something special against the Negro for 250 years now has to do something special for the Negro. And I think if we remember that, then we can begin to grapple with the legacy of inequality, with looking at, you know, redistributive mechanisms, with challenging capitalism's emphasis on, you know, material goods and commodities, because black people on the auction block were reduced to a material good and, you know, seen as a thing. And so there's got to be some extraordinary rejiggering of how things are, trying to figure out how we motivate ourselves to move forward in a different fashion by acknowledging the humanity of black people and by acknowledging the stuff we did that was so funky, foul, nefarious, and tragic, even traumatic to us as a people. That stuff has to be thrown into the equation.
Should there be somebody in the White House whose special assignment is to be the ambassador of civil rights? Should there be a cabinet position? Should what do you think of those ideas?
That would be somebody incredible. That's just a great focused? Idea. I mean, to have a civil rights czar or civil Black Lives Matter, monitor, so to speak. Thinking about the interests of black people, because the interests of black people are the interests of this nation. What's good for us is good for the nation. For instance, during the fight over the Civil Rights Bill in 64, some Southern senators thought they'd be slick and say, I know how we can sink it, and Congress people. We can put a rider on there for women's rights as well. Well, I'll be darned both of them passed. And so Title IX was born out of that. So what's good for black people is good for America. And we got to figure out how to appreciate the commitments, the contributions, and the extreme loyalty of black people to this nation, and figure out how we can, make good on the promise to address everybody equitably and fairly and to do right by everybody in our country.
They did the same thing with our constitutional amendment, which they tied to the Equal Rights Amendment. It was an amendment that was pushed through the Senate. It was a constitutional amendment that was pushed through the Senate by Ed Brooke, who was a black senator from Massachusetts. And a D.C. resident, originally a D.C. resident. He moved to Massachusetts because there was nothing for him to run for in the District of Columbia. But let me ask you one last question before I let Maria go to the few final questions, and that is your book, which was reviewed by NPR. They said your book is full of frustration, pain, admiration, and ultimately hope. So what is the hope, Dr. Dyson?
The hope is that we will continue to grapple with inequality. The hope is we will continue to make forward movement. The hope is we will continue to raise high the bloodstained banner of truth, democracy, freedom, justice in this nation. The hope is that as we get pointed out to us the flaws of our society, that we will reckon with them and acknowledge them and then move forward, that we would collectively leverage the power and the tremendous determination we have generated as a people for the advancement of this nation, and that America will finally, in the words of Langston Hughes, be America to us.
Maria, do you have a question?
I do. That's hopeful. Yeah. Dr. Dyson, it's often said that each one of us has a book in us, and you've written over 20 of them, including 7 New York Times bestsellers. What kind of discipline does it take, and what does that process look like?
Yeah, it takes quite a bit of discipline if you do it right. And, you got to say no to people. You got to say no to opportunities. I couldn't say no to y'all.
you've got to, God bless you.
Try to focus on, your work, be consistent, write as much as you can each day. Half the struggle is sitting in that seat, keeping your butt in place, and not being distracted by Instagram or Twitter or social media, but to move forward. And I think it's extremely important as a writer to think critically, to think, self-critically, to be introspective, to understand what, one's interests are, but also how one best channels the flow of words that will make a contribution to whatever arena, area, or subject matter that one is writing about, that one is concerned with, that one is obsessed by, and make the best contribution possible by being as smart as you can, as eloquent as you can, and as committed to the subject as possible to translate it into lucid language and to clear, concise expression that allows you to explain to people who may not have an interest or may not have an expertise, what you're trying to say, why it makes a difference, what difference it makes, and how we will be better if we abide by your words. That's what the challenge of, I think, any author is.
So I have a friend who's a Hollywood scriptwriter. He did all kinds of other things prior to that. But he says that 90% of writing is rewriting. Is
yep,
that what you've experienced?
The best writer is a rewriter. There's no question about that. Yeah, you got to keep writing, rewriting, write and rewrite again. And the best writer is a rewriter. And you've got to keep revising, keep getting it right, move a comma, move a sentence, move a punctuation mark, move a semicolon, you know, constantly play with the flow of language, constantly grapple with the serious and sober subjects that you're concerned about and the sense of humor that you might add, a kind of levity that might prevail as well. Whatever you need to do to connect with your audience, to open up your own mind so that ideas can flow and that you're able to be consistently engaged and expressing your ideas in a way that allows you to continue to be relevant. That's what I've tried to do.
Because long time coming, you almost had kind of like a deadline because it was so topical that you wanted to get it into people's hands, and then it becomes an instant national bestseller. How did that up the stakes for you in terms of your production?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, though. You got to stay on task. You know, you can't be goofing around. You know, you can't be watching I Care For You or whatever you're watching on Netflix, although that was a dope movie. You can't watch your favorite movies. I can't watch The Godfather for maybe the 200th time or something, you know.
My favorite movie right. of all time. Because I had a documentation, I have to tell you, I just watched it today. It reminds me of the way my Italian grandmother used to run our family.
It's amazing, right? Brilliant. It's amazing. Why don't you come to me first?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, now
I believe in America. America's made my fortune. It started right off, you know.
Exactly.
No, it's a remarkable film, but you got to stay on task. You got to stay on message. And you got to continue to do everything you can to maximize your potential and to deepen your awareness about the world around you so that it can contribute to your own, you know, understanding of what you're writing about and allow you to connect even more fluidly with your audience.
I have the million-dollar question here from Laura in New York. Doctor, she wants to know if you would consider running for public office. I think she's ready to vote for you if you decide to run in New York. Have you ever considered?
No, I'm gonna leave that to Senator Brown, Ms. Sanchez. If she throws her head in, I can't. I'm gonna stay outside, write what I can, think what I can, talk what I can, preach what I can, and bear witness to the truth as best I can in the role I have as a social critic, a cultural critic, and a social activist. I think that's my best gift and my best role.
Well, and that I would say is just one more indication of how smart you really are.
Bless you.
We're so lucky to have had you tonight.
Thank you.
Dr. Dyson. We're running out of time here. Maria, do you have anything else to say to Dr. Dyson before we sign off here?
Other than an expression of gratitude on behalf of you and me for you, Dr. Dyson, making us a part of your crowded, busy, chaotic, productive, inspirational life. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Look forward to coming back soon.
Yeah, I hope you will. And, you know, at the end of the show, we always dedicate a song to the to our guests, and it was a tough choice tonight, seeing that you had written a book about Marvin Gaye, and I love Marvin Gaye, but I've chosen another song in honor of Trisha and the other young people in my life who are who are always making me more aware. This is a song by the rapper Common and John Legend, and it's called Yeah, and this goes out to you, Dr. Dyson. And please thank your lovely wife, who was instrumental in our arrangements. We very much appreciate her help.
Thank you.
And we hope you come back again soon.
Look forward to it.
And continued success.
All right. Thank you so much.
Bye. Bye. Yeah, I need to get together with him and watch The Godfather sometime. My favorite movie.
It's my boyfriend's favorite, and we have a movie poster in our home theater.
Yeah, you know, it's like it's
what
like,
the it heck, you guys?
Like, Don Corleone and my grandmother really were cut from the same cloth. They really
wow.
were.
Wow.
Anyway, Maria, you want to say goodbye?
Adios. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.